Washington versus Department of Education.
May it please the court, I'm Quinn Lobato on behalf of plaintiff appellant Anthony Robinson. The issue before the court today is whether or not the language of the Fair Credit Reporting Act has waived the sovereign immunity of the United States with respect to two sections, section 1681N and 1681O. Inconceivable, extraordinary, absurd, unlikely. These are the words the government uses to describe the language in the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And notably, the one word you won't hear is the only word that matters, which is ambiguous. I will argue today that there are two questions this court should be looking at. One. Okay. Is that better, Your Honor? Okay. The first issue I'll be discussing is what is the appropriate test that this court should be applying when it's analyzing whether or not the sovereign immunity of the United States was waived under this statute. And the second issue is whether or not there's any special reason or rule or canon of construction that would allow this court to override the plain, unambiguous language of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which I will argue there is no such reason. To the first point of the correct test, it's important that the government acknowledges that the test the court should employ when it's looking at whether or not language in a statute waives sovereign immunity is whether or not that language is unequivocal. Here, the government has made no argument whatsoever that there's any ambiguity or any equivocal nature to the language of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. If we look at the very first section of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, 1681A, what we will see is that the very first thing Congress says is that the definitions and rules of construction set forth in this section are applicable for purposes of this subchapter. So the government cites many cases where they say you don't have to apply the same meaning in every instance in a statute. That does not and cannot apply here, because when you're looking at the Fair Credit Report Act, Congress has mandated that the word person be applicable for every provision in the subchapter. And that's at the very beginning of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. We see the very... sometimes it says section rather than subchapter. So in this case, this is at the beginning of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and it says the entire subchapter. So while it would not apply to the Fair Credit Reporting Act is one subchapter of the Consumer Credit Protection Act, along with the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and the other acts that regulate consumer protection. So you wouldn't use this definition of person in the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, for example. It's limited to this subchapter. But yes, by putting this language in there, Congress is intending that the same meaning apply throughout this specific subchapter. This is my first time here. I apologize. So that's 1681A. The provisions were.
I've seen an awful lot of sovereign immunity waivers, and I must say I've never seen a waiver of sovereign immunity, a massive, what you pretend is a massive waiver of sovereign immunity, done in such an offhanded way as this. One of the waivers of sovereign immunity, they vary a bit in their language, but all of them seem to have, Congress seemed to have devoted more care and thought than it had here. If you look at the Federal Tort Claims Act, for example, and they often begin, the Clean Water Act is the same way they refer to the government as the United States. It says the United States should be liable respecting the provisions of this title relating to tort claims in the same manner and to the same extent as a private individual under like circumstances, but shall not be liable for interest prior to judgment or for punitive damages. And that seems more or less typical of waivers of sovereign immunity. They're done with some explicit care as to the terms. And here, you're claiming that really some exposing the government to massive liabilities could be done in this offhanded fashion. That troubles me because I haven't seen waivers of sovereign immunity be this casually effectuated.
While I respect Your Honor's concern, I don't agree that it was casually done. If you look at the 1996 amendment to the Fair Credit Reporting Act, it was specifically intended to dramatically expand liability. Before the Fair Credit Reporting Act in 1970, when it was created, it was only designed to cover credit reporting agencies. 1996, it was expanded to cover furnishers as well. So Congress is in the mindset of expanding liability greatly. So it's not accidentally creating liability by the interplay of sections.
Way you would interpret this, there would be a waiver of sovereign immunity as to foreign governments. There would be a waiver of sovereign immunity as to state governments. There'd be a waiver of sovereign immunity as to tribal governments. I mean, that's astonishing breadth. Federal, state, tribal governments, and waiving. It's unconstitutional to interpret it that way, because in the Seminole Tribes case, the Supreme Court said Congress doesn't have the authority to waive state sovereign immunity, and yet you want us to give an interpretation of the statute that would have Congress indulging in an unconstitutional act.
Your Honor, I would ask you to look at the RFRA. That's the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. In the City of Bourne case, the Supreme Court did hold that it could not apply, the RFRA could not apply to states. It was unconstitutional in that context. But since then, Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld that it still applies to the federal government of the United States. So sovereign immunity is not a package deal. If the court finds for...
Yes, in the way that you would have the statute expressed, we just can't carve out the exception. That the statute doesn't provide for if we take your view.
Respectfully, I think it's the government that's carving out exceptions here.
You're saying that it applies so broadly that every government around the world and every tribal entity and every state government has had its sovereign immunity waived by Congress. I mean, that's a principle of staggering breadth.
Respectfully, that's not the basis of our argument, because the court does not have before it any issue about whether the state has waived its sovereign immunity. And that the importance of focusing.
So, what is your position with respect to that? Is it, in fact, as broad a waiver as Judge Wilkinson has just described?
My position is that it's a waiver of the United States federal sovereign immunity, which is the only issue before the court. Well, they're subject to different, completely different considerations, which was the second point I was going to make. How does the court analyze this statute? It doesn't have to consider every application. It has to consider the application of the statute.
Congress didn't parse this the way you're trying to parse it now, which is, well, some will not others, some not others. Let me ask you another question, because looking at what the other circuits have done, the Seventh Circuit seemed to go away initially, but then there was another later Seventh Circuit opinion that seemed to back off from that and said, no, there's no waiver of tribal sovereign immunity at all. They're beginning to backpack. And the Ninth Circuit case by Judge McKeon seems flatly contrary.
Those cases actually highlight one of the issues here. When you're looking at the government's brief, they conflate the waiver of state sovereign immunity with the waiver of federal sovereign immunity. You cannot conflate them. There's a constitutional principle in a constitutional amendment, the 11th Amendment, which prohibits Congress from waiving the sovereign immunity of the states.
Would you agree that you have to look at the statute as a whole? If you do that,
What about, do you think Congress intended to subject the federal agency to criminal prosecution?
I don't think the court needs to reach that decision. And the principle, not in this case, absolutely not. There, the principle of law that I think the court is overlooking is that one, essentially what you're considering a mistake, did if it...
I don't want you to slide off with the implications of Judge Floyd's questions, because it was brought up by the Ninth Circuit. There's a question that I have, which is you're going to look at the statute as a whole. We're going to have the people criminally prosecuting the federal government. The federal government criminally prosecuting the federal government. How are we going to capture that case? United States versus United States?
What the court is...
That's an odd caption for a case.
The court is highlighting what can be considered as a mistake. So it's not the purview of the court to correct what would be a mistake. And the important principles that the court should not overlook in this case are, one, the clear and...
Is it your position that this opens up the United States government to criminal prosecution?
No, Your Honor, because it's not necessary to reach the question of the interpretation of Q and whether Congress intended to waive the intent there, because the intent...
You interpret first that it suffices to waive immunity, then you would automatically subject...
Yes, that's...
You have to go with your interpretation throughout the statute. And the United States would be subject to criminal liability. Not to mention, it would be suing itself, the Federal Trade Commission, for example, and the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau would be suing the United States, and you have some parts of the United States government suing other parts of the United States government because the Federal Trade Commission has enforcement responsibility.
That's correct.
And it would be suing, the government would be suing itself civilly, and the government would be prosecuting itself criminally. And all of this under a very direct,
clear, unequivocal language. There's no problem with the Congress doing that. The Congress has every right to do that. The sovereign immunity of the United States can be waived by Congress, and that's the fundamental overriding principle. The court is not supposed to go into an elaborate consideration of whether or not that was an appropriate decision. Perhaps you think it's too broad. Perhaps you think they didn't budget for it as the government raises the issue. But that's not the test that is applicable.
I have a great deal of respect for Judge Easterbrook, but I think he got the Seventh Circuit case playing out wrong, and the Seventh Circuit has backed away from it, and I think Judge McKinnon's opinion in the Ninth Circuit, I read them both. I thought Judge McKinnon's opinion was one of the most persuasive and one of the most thorough that I've read. I'm just not anxious to fly in direct conflict.
Well, if you look at the authority he relied on in that, he's misconstruing the authority, and that's the important thing. The government has taken, in the court in the Ninth Circuit, has taken various canons of construction and crafted this big ball of other reasons why the court should ignore the plain language of the statute. And I'm encouraging this court to stick to the number one overriding and Supreme Court dictated principle in statutory construction, which is you look at the intent expressed in the statute. You don't go into congressional history. You don't go into whether or not Congress may have considered the ramifications of it. I mean, that's legislating from the bench, is it not? How are we even considering these things? They're not relevant, and they don't cast doubt. And when you do have cases where the court has said, okay, I see plain language, I see your argument, but I have other reasons, when we're going plain language plus, when we get to plain language plus... Okay. All right, Your Honor. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, but you've got some rebuttal now.
Good morning. May it please the court, Sarah Carroll on behalf of the government. Congress can waive sovereign immunity of the United States only if it speaks unequivocally and clearly. As the Ninth Circuit held last year in Daniel V. National Park Service, as I know the court is aware, Congress did not do so in FCRA. A plaintiff's central submission is that the court has no choice but to mechanically apply the statutory definition of person throughout the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
About that, because Congress also had the benefit of Judge Easterbrook's decision in the Seventh Circuit case and did nothing to change the statute in response, doesn't that suggest that if not to satisfy, but if you care enough about it to want to clarify the true intent of the amendment?
I'm not sure how much inference can typically be drawn from congressional inaction, Your Honor. I mean, courts decide things all the time, and sometimes Congress steps in to correct it, but sometimes it doesn't. But I think what's more important is that plaintiff's central submission here is directly contrary to the Supreme Court's decision in Employees of the Department of Public Health and Welfare, which concerned the Fair Labor Standards Act, which had long imposed damages on employers. And then in 1966, Congress amended the act to add state hospitals to the definition of employer. And the Supreme Court nonetheless held that that was not a waiver of sovereign immunity. The court recognized that by the, quote, literal language of the statute, state hospitals were now subject to damages under the FLSA. But Congress said that, you know, said that Congress acting responsibly would be presumed not to have done such a thing without somehow addressing it in a clearer way.
I relied fairly extensively on legislative history to reach that result.
The case mentioned that there was nothing in the legislative history. I don't think it is. As far as I'm aware, the Supreme Court has never questioned, much less overruled, employees, so it remains binding precedent. But the Supreme Court has looked to legislative history and also statutory structure and context, which we are also relying on probably more heavily. In more recent years, you know, for example, in U.S. Department of Energy, which is a 1992 decision when the court was already in, you know, a pretty textualist mindset, the court is looking to whether there is anything in the statute's structure or context that would have led Congress to believe that it was subjecting the United States to punitive, I think it was civil penalties. And, you know, outside the sovereign immunity.
In the United States, punitive damages as well, the plaintiffs. Interpretation was about.
Yes, that's absolutely right, Your Honor. And when Congress wants to subject the United States to punitive damages, it says so more clearly. As Your Honors have noted, a number of other anomalies would also arise from plaintiff's theory, which again is that this person definition has to be mechanically placed in every provision of the act that uses the word person. You know, as Judge Floyd first noted, it would subject the United States to criminal liability, a result that the Ninth Circuit described as, quote, patently absurd and unprecedented. As Judge Wilkinson noted, just a few months before these 1996 amendments, the Supreme Court had decided the landmark case of Seminole Tribe, in which it held that Congress could not subject states to private damages actions under the Commerce Clause. And under plaintiff's theory, Congress would have then, just a few months later, turned around and passed this patently unconstitutional act as applied to this to state governments. And plaintiff offered no basis for treating states or foreign governments or local governments any different from the federal government under her reading.
One of the things that concerns me is that we would run, I can't even begin to estimate the number of problems we'd be creating for ourselves, but it's interesting to me that, as I read it, also in this same statute, and I think it's section 1681 UJ, the FBI is given certain access.
Yes.
To these to consumer reports, and the statute goes into great lengths talking about the degree to which sovereign immunity is waived in cases where the FBI abuses its access. So you have in this statute a very limited waiver of sovereign immunity in very limited circumstances.
Right.
Which Congress gave great thought to, and I'm not sure how I would resolve the tension between the thought that is given to the waiver in 16UJ, which would have been totally unnecessary if the plaintiff's broad, sweeping view of the term person in AB were adopted, that whole limited waiver would have been just surplusage.
I completely agree, Your Honor. 1681U is very explicit in waiving the United States sovereign immunity for a limited scope of conduct. And 1681U, I think, also was enacted just a few months before the 1996 amendments on which plaintiff relies. So it would have been very peculiar if Congress had enacted that thoughtful, narrow waiver, and then a few months later just turned around and sort of blew the whole thing up with this broad definition of person that, under plaintiff's theory, is sort of being imported into the whole act. Another point that I think... Sure.
Judge Wilkinson, the provision of the Federal Tort Claims Act, or the waiver, is very explicit. It defines the waiver to include the United States. Do you think that the use of the United States is absolutely necessary for those magic words in order to waive sovereign immunity or something less than that?
Your Honor, I don't think that magic words are necessary. I think that there could be some waiver that Congress could craft that would be explicit and unequivocal and leave no doubt about what Congress was trying to do, even if it didn't use the term United States. But that's not what we have here.
So, with respect to the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, Fifth Circuit in that case suggested that language very similar to what we have here, use of government as opposed to the United States, was enough to waive sovereign immunity. I guess two questions. Is it the government's position that case was incorrectly decided? Answer that one first.
So my understanding of the government's position is that we view the Equal Credit Opportunity Act differently than FCRA because the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, as this Office of Legal Counsel opinion that plaintiff cites in her brief notes, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act has an express non-waiver of the United States immunity with respect to punitive damages. And I think that the conclusion has been, well, when you're expressly making clear that you're reserving immunity with respect to punitive damages, that has to imply that you're waiving immunity with respect to something else.
But,
well, that is, you know, the plain text of the provision that's at issue there. So I think that goes to underscore that magic words aren't needed, but there Congress made very, very clear that, yes, it was thinking specifically about U.S. government liability, and it was intending to impose some sort of liability on the government, but not punitive damages. That's very different from here, where we have this 1970 Act that's, you know, quite narrow and targeted, really, which, as plaintiff noted, principally regulated consumer reporting agencies and used the person definition only for that, well, primarily for that purpose, to define the scope of permissible conduct for consumer reporting agencies. And plaintiff's theory is that then, 26 years later, in 1996, when Congress essentially engrafted this new, very broad statutory scheme on top of the narrow and tailored 1970 Act, it silently, intended to have this broad person definition that did very different work in 1970 apply mechanically throughout the entire act. And there's just...
You mentioned earlier that I thought looking to legislative history was problematic because of the notion that that's not appropriate in the context of plain language. But I will have to say that perhaps this is a question that directed at your colleague, that it seemed very odd that this kind of a waiver generated nary a peep from anyone when this change was made. And on top of that, there was no accounting for the significant liability that would be imposed on the government as a result of that by the bean counters in the federal government. None of that. That suggests to me that this is not something that the government intended, but I'll leave that for your colleague.
Well, I think I do think that's a great point, Judge Diaz. And in the Sossaman decision in 2011, while not actually, I don't think, looking at legislative history, Justice Thomas noted that the purpose of looking for a clear statement in the statute is to make sure that Congress is acting deliberately and intentionally and is not, resolving important issues inadvertently by use of broad or ambiguous language. So I think that in the special context of sovereign immunity, where we are particularly concerned about figuring out what Congress actually was thinking and what Congress actually intended, I think that is an important thing to look at. And as Your Honor notes, for example, the Congressional Budget Office estimated the cost to the government of the predecessor bills to the 1996 Act as being quite small, less than $10 million, comprised, I think, of judicial costs and then costs of the executive branch in enforcing the Act, not potentially sweeping damages liability by newly opening the government to monetary damages for a broad range of conduct in which the government routinely engages. I think it's really the absence of some clear statement that really leaves no doubt about what Congress is doing. I think, as Judge Wilkinson,
the abstract language is perfect. Yes, the problem is that you're asking us to look beyond the language to consider context and other considerations.
Right, but that's absolutely what courts are supposed to do in the context of sovereign immunity, which is a special, whatever a court might think of adhering to plain language in other settings.
We do need to concede that the language, at least in the abstract, is not at all ambiguous.
I don't think we would concede that, Your Honor. I think that when Congress is subjecting the United States to damages, it speaks very clearly, and its failure to do so here creates an ambiguity in the statute, as I think the Ninth Circuit rightly recognized. And I would note again that the interpretive method that plaintiff is asking this court to adopt is directly contrary to employees of the Department of Public Health and Welfare, which, sure, it's a somewhat old Supreme Court decision, but it's binding precedent. And in years since then, the Supreme Court has, again, reaffirmed that when we're in the area of sovereign immunity or other areas where there are especially sensitive considerations at stake, courts need to be very careful in figuring out what Congress did. For example, these are not sovereign immunity cases, but in Bond or in Northwest Austin, there too you had statutory definitions that looked pretty clear on their face, but nonetheless the Supreme Court held, well, Congress couldn't possibly have actually intended to do this. So Congress used the Supreme Court used the other interpretive tools that were available to try to figure out what Congress actually intended to be doing.
I would like to believe that Congress reacted immediately to every circuit court opinion that we handed down. Unfortunately, or fortunately, or whatever, it's not at all unusual for Congress, which has an enormous amount on its plate.
Yes.
So that's something. Marinate for a while and see what other circuit courts have come up with and what the Supreme Court has come up with. But it's the case many, many times that Congress, as busy as it is, does not react to a single circuit court decision. There's this sort of de rigueur over there that you let the problem germinate and marinate for a while and see how the circuits as a whole handle it and see how the Supreme Court deals with it. So that doesn't strike me as unusual.
Yes.
They didn't react after Daniel so far either.
Right.
The Ninth Circuit case came down, as far as I know, they haven't reacted to that.
Right. I'm not aware of any reaction either, Your Honor.
Well, one of the things I think my friend Judge Diaz points out correctly that you can't make this a matter of talismanic phrases or magic words. But what you can do is subject it to the fact that all of the discussions of this subject have gotten to say that the waiver has to be unequivocal and unambiguous. I was wondering what you made of the Supreme Court's interpretation of Cooper and the meaning it gave to the word person there in that decision.
Right. So there the court, if I recall correctly, was interpreting the Sherman Act and considering whether the United States should be considered a person under the Sherman Act. And although there I don't believe person was a statutorily defined term, the Supreme Court said, well, customarily the government is not considered a person, while corporations and some other organizational entities are. And the Supreme Court said, that it would be especially unlikely that Congress would intend for the United States to be treated as a person under the Sherman Act, because that would open the United States to the liabilities that the Sherman Act imposes on persons. Right, that's right. But I think that, you know, when Congress engrafted this new 1996 statute on top of the 1970 Act, I think it's quite possible that what Congress really was thinking, to the extent it considered the matter, was this more conventional meaning of person that the Supreme Court considered in Cooper.
What I felt like I had to come back to in the end was somebody mentioned it. It may have been Judge Floyd. I think it was Judge Floyd mentioned it. That in trying to figure out what Congress really meant to do, it's not wrong to take a holistic view. And in fact, I think we probably share that context is important in statutory construction, to take a holistic view. I just, speaking for myself alone, thought that a waiver disalitically against our sovereign immunity, our foreign governments, state governments, and all the constitutional problems that involve tribal governments subjected the United States to prosecution, criminal prosecution, the other waivers, limited as they are, become essential surplus energy. Just as a practical matter, if you take a statute as a whole, there are a lot of problems down the road.
Yes, I agree.
A lot.
Mm-hmm.
People couldn't figure out how to solve.
Right. I think.
I couldn't figure out how to solve.
Right. I mean, I think that sums this up pretty well, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has said over and over, including in recent years, that statutory construction is a holistic endeavor. And as part of that holistic endeavor, all the more so in the context of sovereign immunity, you have to look at statutory context and structure and the implications of the interpretation that you're considering for the statute as a whole. And I think the court has pretty well canvassed many of the anomalies that would arise from taking plaintiff's view and applying the person definition throughout the entire act. And in light of all those anomalies, as the Ninth Circuit noted in Daniel, as Judge McKeown explained, there's just, at a minimum, a whole lot of doubt about whether Congress actually wanted that. And I would submit that there is no reason to think that Congress intended that. I'm happy to answer any other questions that the court might have. Thank you.
Yes, Your
Honor.
One of the first things I'd like to point out is that the language in 1681 UJ would not become surplus if you were to interpret the way that we advocate. Because when you look at 1681 UJ, the liability that the FBI is subjected to, it is not identical to the other statute in 1681 NNO. The first provision, the FBI is subject to $100 statutory damages. The other provision is $100 to $1,000. So if you're looking at the statute and you're relying on the guiding principle you should be relying on, which is the language of the statute, not outside the statute, we see that within the statute, there is a reason for that specific waiver, and it's to distinguish it and treat it differently. The FBI is subject to a different set of fines. So,
I just
said
there you have an example of an explicit and unambiguous waiver of sovereign immunity, and what you're arguing for is just a massive sweeping waiver of sovereign immunity, and it seems to me that Congress, when it was interpreting UJ, recognized the principle that if it was going to waive sovereign immunity, that it had to be done in somewhat precise, unequivocal terms.
Well, I think what you're missing is that statute, the FBI statute, only applies to the government. So it doesn't apply to persons. It wouldn't be appropriate to use the word person with that statute, because then you would have something that doesn't make sense. It's not subjecting banks or other furnishers under the Fair Credit Reporting Act to those statutes. So a lot of the cases the government relies on to say there's a principle where if... Well, what it recognized was that it didn't want to treat the FBI the same as violations of every other statute. It gave it a different progression in the amount of damages. It's not identical. It's not surplusage. It's not identical. And also, if Congress is treating the federal government and the executive branch as any other person who decides to furnish information under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the only way to guarantee accuracy in that system is for the federal government to be subjected to the same rules and the same liabilities as everybody else. Otherwise, if we want to take a step back and look at what Congress is doing and what Congress's intention are, which I strongly argue against, we don't need to do that. But if we were to look at it, the Fair Credit Reporting Act is so that consumers have confidence and businesses have confidence in the accuracy of credit reports. Now we're saying Congress wanted to maximize accuracy by exempting the federal government from participating in a system and being liable under the same rules as everybody else in that system. So it would totally undermine the purposes of the Fair Credit Reporting Act to exempt the federal government under there. Again, the court shouldn't even be looking at this because there's no reason, and the government cited no cases whatsoever that stand for the proposition that in the waiver of United States federal sovereign immunity as distinct from state sovereign immunity.
When you go there, you're giving up your whole argument, because your whole argument is that everything is waived. And then you double back around and say, oh no, not everything is waived, just federal sovereign immunity, not state sovereign immunity, not tribal sovereign immunity, but...
I'm actually not saying that. I'd love to argue before you on all those separate issues, but that's not what we don't have to reach that. And I think the court can't overlook...
That's not the way the statute is written. I mean, you're so stuck here with an all or nothing proposition.
No, Your Honor. That would be against the principles outlined by the United States Supreme Court, which specifically in the context of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA, said it doesn't apply to states, but oh yes, it does apply to the federal government. The federal government doesn't get out because Congress overstepped its bounds. If Congress oversteps its bounds and violates the Constitution in trying to waive state sovereign immunity and makes that mistake, the courts can come in. It's within the purview of the courts to say that was an unconstitutional exercise of congressional authority. The same principle does not underlie consideration of federal sovereign immunity. There's no constitutional principle that says the federal government can't waive the immunity of the federal government. The case law regarding sovereign immunity comes directly from a history where it is the court restraining itself. And now we're taking a system designed for the court to restrain itself, the court saying if Congress wants for the government to consent to be sued, Congress needs to be clear. Then we're taking that test.
The respective spheres of the Privacy Act and the FCRA.
The Privacy Act regulates disclosures by any government agency of any kind of personal identifying information. So it pretty much involves every single government agency that exists. And the remedies under the Privacy Act are distinct from the remedies under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The Fair Credit Reporting Act does also contain some...
It has a very detailed enforcement scheme and a detailed remedial scheme.
Right. And courts have held that the remedial scheme does not include any monetary damages. So...
What I'm wondering is, because you find in UJ very detailed waivers of sovereign immunity, and then in the Privacy Act, you have a very detailed enforcement scheme and a very detailed remedial scheme. And it just seemed to me that it's hard for me to compromise the very detailed remedial and enforcement very detailed waivers exist with the approach that you're advocating, which seems to me to be just sort of a blockbuster approach in tension, and at odds with the detail that Congress, with which Congress has considered this whole problem elsewhere in law. And I grant you that the Privacy Act and the SCRA don't cover exactly the same thing, but there's a substantial overlap. Congress went about it with a scalpel rather than a bludgeon.
Well, I would just ask this court not to try to correct Congress's mistake to the extent that there is any, and to find that the clear language of the Fair Credit Reporting Act mandates that the sovereign immunity of the United States has been waived.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You want to come down and read counsel, and we will take a brief rest.